You're listening to the History of Ideas podcast from Radio 4. For more information, go to the Radio 4 website.
This is the singing of a comet. You might have heard this extraordinary sound sometime around the middle of November 2014. Magnetic oscillations emitted by the comet Churyumov-Gerasimenko were discovered by Karl-Heinz Glassmeyer, one of the scientists working on the Rosetta mission, and made audible for us by the composer Manuel Senft. At the time, the world was alight with the fervour of scientific promise. What would the discoveries made by the probe landed on the comet reveal about the origins of the universe, of water and life on Earth? But scientists have been looking to the skies for the answers to these questions for centuries, trying to explain the world they found around them using everything available to them. And in the 17th century, for natural philosophers like Isaac Newton and Robert Boyle, working as a modern scientific worldview began to emerge. This meant the new evidence afforded by technologies like telescopes, as well as for them, the most important text on the matter of how everything began, the Bible. The curious minds of the 17th century worked hard to ensure that commentary on scripture was as scientific and as learned as it might be. One of those curious minds, and you might not have heard of him, was a protege of Isaac Newton, and his name was William Whiston.
How did everything begin?
William Whiston was a scientist and theologian in 17th and 18th century England. Like his mentor, Isaac Newton, he tried to use the emerging science of the day to validate biblical stories, notably Noah's flood. He succeeded Newton as Lucasian Professor of Mathematics at the University of Cambridge, and like Newton, his study of scripture led him to question Anglican ideas about the Holy Trinity. Unlike Newton, however, he openly expressed these doubts and was expelled from the post and charged with heresy. He was never convicted, but remained a controversial figure. Dorsa Whiston, a ridge on the moon, is named in his honour.
How did everything begin?
For men like Whiston, perhaps unlike today, the truths of science were not in any kind of opposition to the truths of Scripture. He wrote a book in 1696 called A New Theory of the Earth. In this widely read and influential book, Whiston synchronized the Old Testament story of how everything began with the evidence he found in the material world and the observations of the heavens delivered in the researches of contemporaries like Edmund Halley and Robert Hooke. He argued that the creation, the fall, the flood, and the eventual conflagration of the world were all the products of serial impact by comets, which had been detailed by precise astronomical observation. The attempt to synchronize these accounts might seem like a bizarre project to us now, but reading Whiston's book, I wonder whether he was so very far away from today's scientists. They might, like Tim O'Brien, who is a professor of astrophysics, have access to more powerful technology, but they're also on a determined mission to find out about the beginning of all things. I went to see Tim at the Jodrell Bank Observatory to talk to him about Whiston's ideas, but also to look at his enormous and rather beautiful radio telescope. The idea that that machine is receiving messages from the beginning is remarkable. Oh, it's moving. And one can imagine William Whiston, 1700, say, you know, struggling with Newton's Principia, drawing his own illustrations of comets and other astronomical forces. If he could see this today, what fun he would have.
If we look back at our origins, we look back at where we came from, in a sense it allows us to predict the future, how the universe will become.
And in one sense, that's sort of precisely what Whiston found so fascinating about comets. And I wondered, I mean, you know, was he deluded? He imagined a four-stage process where a comet bashed into the Earth, which was originally smooth, It made it slightly more egg-shaped, knocked it off its axis. Another comet hit and caused the flood. He then talks about God was not very happy with Adam's sin, so boffed the earth again. The final conflagration will be another comet that smashes the earth back into its initial chaotic form. Is this at all plausible?
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting hearing that story. Of course, we don't want to try and connect these things to what's in the Bible, and there's no sense in us doing that. But actually, there's interesting sort of resonances with what you said there about these events, with what we actually feel did happen in the history of the Earth. So, for example, early on in the formation of the Earth, after the Sun had formed at the centre of the solar system, the planets sort of accreted from small objects, sort of grains of dust, stuck together to form larger grains, stuck together to form pebbles, stuck together to form boulders, and eventually the planets grew from that. So early in the history of the Earth, there were massive bombardments of the Earth by comets, by asteroids, by even almost planet-sized other things. That would certainly have influenced the orbit of the Earth and the inclination of the axis. And then this idea of the flood, well, you know, really current, hot scientific topic is, where did the Earth's water come from? And comets is one possibility. And then the end of the world. And we know a collision with something like a comet killed off the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. We're pretty sure of that. And we know there's these things orbiting the Sun now, which may well crash into the Earth at some point in the future. And that could be, for us, the way the world ends.
And that's fascinating, because the point about Whiston is that he's not an idiot. He recognises there is a biblical narrative and wants to preserve it. He just doesn't believe that Moses is a good natural philosopher. In 1707, he delivered the Boyle Lecture, a series of public lectures drawing inspiration from Robert Boyle's commitment to the benefit religion could derive from natural philosophy, and they continue today. There are some, perhaps overambitious historians, who make a case for a shift around the time of Newton and Whiston from a religious worldview to a proto-scientific worldview. But I think that's too simplistic. Whiston couldn't help but tell the truth as he saw it, and Newton wrote many more pages of theology than he did science. The difference was that Newton hid his true theological beliefs. Whiston, however, pursued his ideas, even though they led to personal disaster. What we can see is that there has been a dialogue between religion and science, and that that dialogue continues today. One of the more recent Boyle lecturers is the paleobiologist Simon Conway Morris from Cambridge University. He is renowned for his insights into fossils and early evolution, and he is also a Christian. I wondered whether he ever saw himself, like some of the 17th century natural philosophers, as a kind of priest, reading God's presence in the book of nature.
If one tries to find a simple reconciliation between, if you like, the book of nature and the book of faith, the Bible in particular, in our context, then I'm afraid you're in for a disappointment. The fact of the matter is that, first of all, since the time of Whiston or Boyle or Newton, we know an enormous amount more, and that is irreversible. You don't dispute that at all. Second of all, there are things we know, like the periodic table, or in some senses the nature of gravity, which again are utterly, utterly secure. But on the other hand, it is all still provisional. We all know that at some point, perhaps through physics, most likely, or cosmology, we will have a different understanding of the universe, which might ultimately impinge on the way even biology works. Now, these are all straws in the wind. But I think what is important is it's not so much that things can be falsifiable, than the idea is that anything we regard as a synthesis is incomplete. And I don't think I know any scientist who's absolutely convinced that he's totally correct. We know we're onto things and we know a lot. But on the other hand, there's a great deal more we want to know.
So Whiston's project was to bring contemporary science and the religious narratives of the Old Testament together. Is this something that we still try and do or should do today?
I have to be terribly careful how I choose my words here. My sense is that if you think about things like music or mathematics, they seem to involve, if you like, realities which have enormous traction and huge intellectual power but where on earth do they come from? Are they simply an emergence from what in animals we call numerosity, that is the capacity to recognise numbers? But on the other hand, so far as we know, and I know this is slightly controversial, no animal at all engages in anything remotely like mathematics. They can't add, let alone multiply, let alone think of complex numbers. And yet if one thinks about the success of mathematics and the fact that things like complex numbers have an enormous power in science, one is entitled to ask, if these are abstract, in a manner of speaking, yet we see them, so to speak, through our brains, what on earth are they?
And that, for me, is why we should all know about William Whiston. We should be led by our curiosity. We should be honest, and we should never be deflected from trying to pursue the truth. It makes the point that we don't have to buy into a particular set of religious traditions and institutions in order to be able to recognise that a broader thing called religion might give meaning to what it is to be human, but does not inhibit the curious and scientific mind. Those minds will engage with all evidence and ideas put before them. Whether from the stories of the Bible or the song of a comet, those minds simply want to understand.
That was the History of Ideas podcast from Radio 4.